Next case, 10-1898, Disciplinary Counsel versus Tom John Karras. Mr. Caligiuri.
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor, other distinguished members of this court. My name is Joseph Caligiuri. I represent the Office of Disciplinary Counsel in this matter. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The sole issue before this court today concerns the appropriate sanction for an attorney who is found to have engaged in multiple acts of dishonest conduct in violation of DR-1102A4 and DR-1102A6. There are three reasons why this court should reject the board's recommendation of a public reprimand and impose a 6-month actual suspension from the practice of law. The first reason is that when you consider respondent's misconduct in conjunction with the aggravating factors, his misconduct warrants an actual suspension. The board found that the respondent engaged in a pattern of misconduct whereby he fraudulently notarized Patricia Pidcock's signature, a forged signature, on 4 separate legal instruments on 3 different dates over a 1-year period of time. That first instrument was a promissory note, and Mr. Karras, the respondent, represented a gentleman by the name of Elias Cafenteras, who had loaned money to David Pidcock to run a catering business. David Pidcock and his then-wife, Patricia Pidcock, owned the building that housed that catering business. And in order to protect his investment, Mr. Cafenteras wanted a promissory note. Mr. Karras drew up that promissory note, which required the signature of both David Pidcock and his then-wife, Patricia Pidcock. David Pidcock forged his wife's signature on the promissory note, and then the respondent, Mr. Karras, fraudulently notarized that promissory note.
I was a little confused on the facts as the evidence came in. At one point, he seemed to say there was some other woman that came in that represented herself, and then at some point, the husband said, no, I took the materials out to another room and then brought them in. What was the testimony that came actually out, and was there any corroboration with the secretary or the wife or anything like that?
No, it's a good point, Your Honor. The testimony was a bit varied. This did occur a number of years ago. But basically what was stated was, because this was done on 3 separate dates, David Pidcock said, at one occasion, I came into the office. They told me my wife needed to sign the document. I walked outside. I signed it. And I walked back in and gave it to the attorney. His wife wasn't present. Mrs. Pidcock testified that she's been in the respondent's office before, but she's never signed any documents. On another occasion, Mr. Pidcock said, I was given this, I believe it was the quitclaim deed. I walked outside, went down to my truck, signed my name, signed my wife's name, walked back up and gave it to the attorney. The secretary that witnessed the alleged forged signature was available, yet didn't testify at the disciplinary hearing. Neither did Mr. Cafenteras. So what we were left with at the hearing was the testimony of David Pidcock, who actually came in and admitted that he forged his wife's signature. And then we had Mrs. Pidcock, who came in and said, I didn't sign any of these documents. I didn't know that these documents existed. And then we had a forensic scientist from the Ohio BCI lab say, Mrs. Pidcock never signed the documents.
But then you have Mr. Karras saying, there was a woman that came into my office on 3 separate occasions, and she signed and represented she was Mrs. Pidcock. Did he acknowledge that the real Mrs. Pidcock had shown up on other occasions in his office?
Well, he claimed that Mrs. Pidcock, the real Mrs. Pidcock, had shown up on his office on 2 occasions, and on those 2 occasions, she signed those documents. That was his testimony all the way through this process. And that testimony, which we would allege is blatantly false and would constitute an additional aggravating factor of submitting false statements, because it was proven not only by David Pidcock and Mrs. Pidcock, but by the forensic evidence that Mrs. Pidcock didn't sign these.
And I'm just curious about the weight or lack of weight that the board gave to the forensic expert here from BCI, correct?
Correct.
That's the type of evidence that's submitted at criminal trials.
Correct.
And put before a jury. And I just am a little surprised at that. What's your explanation for that?
I think that the panel actually gave great weight to Rebecca Barrett's testimony. She was the scientist from BCI. In fact, they're basically saying in the report that despite respondents' testimony to the contrary, we know from the forensic evidence that Patricia Pidcock did not sign these documents. Therefore, the respondent could not have notarized them and he could not have witnessed them. So I think they gave it weight. It's just that their sanction was completely inconsistent with the type of misconduct.
Was there a financial loss as a result of this false notary?
Well, it depends on who you ask. But the question came up during the trials, what was the harm here? And Patricia Pidcock and David Pidcock eventually were divorced. And they have a very acrimonious relationship, haven't talked in years, literally three times in, I think, 7 years. And so she was under the impression that her husband had only loaned or received $5,000 from Mr. Cafenteris, when that amount most likely was much, much greater. So she was assuming that she lost money because she didn't know.
I guess the question is there restitution owed or has it been paid?
There is restitution owed as part of an underlying civil case involving David Pidcock and the respondent, Mr. Karras. Mr. Karras settled that matter and agreed to pay Mr. Pidcock $5,000. He made one $400 payment and testified at the disciplinary hearing that he has absolutely no intention of making any further payments to Mr. Pidcock. Another aggravating factor that the board found is failure to make restitution.
Well, what was Pidcock out?
What was he out? Well, the settlement was for $5,000, but he was alleging that when Cafenteris received title to the property fraudulently, that Cafenteris got all the proceeds from the sale of that property. So Mr. Pidcock was saying, I was entitled to $150,000+. Mr. Cafenteris was saying, no, you owed me $150,000 based upon all the money that I had lent you.
But Pidcock lied to everybody about his wife signing this, right?
Well, in 2005, his attorneys executed an affidavit, and he said, my wife and I signed a mortgage and a quitclaim deed. And he admitted that at the hearing, obviously. And then in his deposition testimony in the underlying civil action in 2006, he was asked, is this your wife's signature? And he candidly stated no. And then at the disciplinary hearing, he came in and he explained why he misrepresented that. And basically his explanation was he didn't think much about it. And at the disciplinary hearing, he stated that it was he that forged the document and the documents. And it was completely obvious.
So the forger is owed money from his lawyer. Is that right?
Well, Mr. Pidcock is owed $5,000 from the respondent, Tom Karras. That was not his lawyer.
Oh.
And what weight should we give to the testimony of Judge Kimbler and the prosecuting attorney, Dean Holman?
I think it should be given some weight in the sense that they testified that they've known the respondent for quite a period of time. They testified that he has a decent reputation in the legal community, but that should not carry the day. What should carry the day is the fact that there were three aggravating factors in the case, one of which is that the respondent to this day has refused to acknowledge the wrongful nature of his misconduct. And therefore, the testimony regarding his character pales in comparison to the fact that this is an attorney that lied during a disciplinary hearing. And
Do you think that this individual should be suspended for a period of 6 months, but we should stay the suspension?
No, my recommendation is that it should be an actual suspension.
Oh, an actual six-month suspension.
Yes.
And Mr. Karras is in line with the Board of Grievances, which recommended a public reprimand for this conduct.
He is now. That's correct.
Right. Originally, you had asked for a one-year suspension, correct?
That is correct.
And the Court of Appeals based its Board of Commissioners followed the panel's recommendation based on two cases, the Daugherty case and the Russell case. Could you comment on those? Both were public reprimands issued there.
Absolutely. That would have been the third reason why I'm suggesting this court reject the board's recommendation. The reliance on both of those cases was completely misplaced. The Doherty case involved an isolated incidence of misconduct in which an attorney notarized the affiant's signature on a liquor permit application one time. She accepted complete responsibility, expressed remorse for the conduct, and admitted it immediately. In that case, the court specifically stated that there was no forgery and that there was no knowledge of the forgery. It just turned out later that the lawyer learned that someone else had signed this document. So that's the reason why the court went with a public reprimand. It's interesting to note in that case it was a 4-3 decision, and the three dissenting justices would have imposed an actual 6-month suspension from the practice of law despite overwhelming mitigating factors. And the Russell case is very similar. It was an isolated incident in which an attorney's client had transferred property to the client's in-laws. The client then came back to the attorney and said, the in-laws want to transfer the property back to us. The attorney gave them the deeds. The people allegedly executed the deeds, and they came back not notarized. And the client said, you know, my in-laws are ill. They can't get to a notary. Can you simply go ahead and notarize them? The lawyer did that. It was an isolated lapse of judgment based upon his belief from the client that the signatures were genuine. They turned out to be forgeries. And in that case, the court again stated he had no knowledge of the forgery. He didn't forge the signatures. He was a 44-year practitioner. He accepted responsibility, expressed remorse, and even paid the legal fees that the in-laws incurred to gain clear title to the property. So in this case, we have a pattern of misconduct. We have absolutely no remorse and a refusal to acknowledge the wrongfulness of his misconduct. Those are aggravating factors which would require an actual suspension from the practice of law.
Counsel, I'm still unclear as to how this unfolded with respect to the respondent. He's preparing the document. He prepared the documents to protect his client.
Correct.
And he gave them to the forger.
He gave them to David Pidcock, who forged his wife's signature on every one of those documents.
Okay, and at what point did he realize that, Pidcock had forged the documents?
It came up in some underlying litigation that Patricia Pidcock was not involved in.
So this is long after they're recorded and everything else?
Yes, the documents were recorded.
So how is that different from the case that you pointed out that you said we should distinguish it from, because didn't you say that lawyer also didn't know?
This lawyer did know. Mr. Karras knew because Ms. Pidcock did not sign any of these documents, and he not only notarized them, but he signed as a witness to them as well.
Okay. I get that you say he knew she wasn't present.
Right.
And you're saying the lawyer in the other case, the person was present?
No, the lawyer in the other case, there was a representation that the signature was genuine. Here, Mr. Karras basically gave the documents to Mr. Pidcock, who walked out the door and came back in with them signed. I mean, Mr. Karras just turned a blind eye to the misconduct.
Didn't he do it on more than one occasion, too?
Yes, he did it on three separate occasions.
Right. And each time, as the notary, he is required to say that he witnessed the person signing in front of him. And on three separate occasions, he did not do that. He did not witness Mrs. Pidcock sign the documents.
That's exactly correct. And he also had his secretary sign as a witness to those documents.
But he's saying he's not acknowledging Mrs. Pidcock didn't walk through the door and sign those documents in his office. He's saying just the opposite, that Mrs. Pidcock or, on three separate occasions, a woman claiming to be Mrs. Pidcock came in to forge a quitclaim deed.
What he's saying now and what he said at the hearing was that he now recalls with specificity that it was Mrs. Pidcock that came into his office and signed each one of those documents. In 2007, during his deposition testimony, he was alleging that someone purporting to be Mrs. Pidcock had come in and signed the documents. But now he's saying, 3 years later, I remember clearly that it was Mrs. Pidcock, the actual Mrs. Pidcock, that signed the documents.
And there's been no corroboration of that?
Absolutely none. Matter of fact, the evidence was beyond any doubt that Patricia Pidcock did not sign the documents. So I would respectfully request this court reject the board's recommendation of a reprimand and impose a six-month actual suspension. Thank you.
Thank you. You have about 45 seconds left for your rebuttal. Ms. Sabella?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Mary L. Sabella, and I represent Tom Karras, the respondent in this matter. This court has held on a number of occasions that the hearing panel's determination as to the credibility of the witnesses will not be overturned by this court unless the manifest weight of the record says otherwise. We would disagree with respect to the testimony and what is in the record, as Relator has posited it to the court. Let me say first that the hearing panel determined the credibility of the witnesses and determined that Mr. Karras did not lie in his 2007 deposition. The hearing panel recommended to the board that the board dismiss that count. The board accepted that recommendation and, in fact, did dismiss count two.
Also, does that preclude us from looking at the evidence and being convinced that there was an error made by the panel?
Since this was a board dismissal and not an unanimous dismissal by the three hearing panel, that issue is available to this court to decide. We would posit that the evidence does not support that. And here's why we would posit that. If you look at the answer brief, we have cited on the exact pages of the transcript, and I believe you'll find it on pages 31 and 32 of the hearing transcript, that Patricia Pidcock admitted at the hearing, and she admitted in her prior deposition testimony, that she was in Mr. Karras's office on two occasions, and on those two occasions, during which she was in Mr. Karras's office, Mr. Karras was there, Mr. Cafanteris was there, Mr. Fortunas was there. Mr. Fortunas did testify. And her husband, David Pidcock, was there. And Mrs. Pidcock's memory of what occurred on those two occasions when she was in Mr. Karras's office is that there were discussions with respect to the monies that Mr. Cafanteris was loaning to Mr. Pidcock for the catering business. So she was actually present. Okay. So, and it's Mr. Karras's.
He was just confused. He thought that she did sign it, and I mean, what's the point if she happened to be in his office on two separate occasions? They weren't the occasions when these documents were executed.
That was not the testimony of Mr. Karras and Mr. Fortunas. Their testimony was that they were present in the office. Mrs. Pidcock was present. The documents were signed. They were notarized, and everything occurred.
So the forensic expert here is wrong.
Well, what we're saying is that
— Well, it's either yes or no. She's either wrong or not.
Well, I don't think I can say yes or no. What I can answer is that Mr. Fortunas's recollection of what occurred and Mr. Karras's recollection of what occurred is that Mrs. Pidcock was present in Mr. Karras's office on those two occasions when the documents were signed.
All right. What about the respondent's secretary? She didn't testify, and she's one of the witnesses.
She was not listed on either witness list.
No. Witness to the document.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mr. Karras's counsel at the hearing did ask Mr. Karras why his secretary was not appearing. Objection was made. It was sustained. He wasn't permitted to answer the question. So it's not in the record. I can answer the question if you'd like. I can also indicate to you that if you look at Relator's Exhibit nine, in Mr. Karras's response to the letter of inquiry, he says to Relator, go ahead and call my secretary and find out what happened. My understanding is that call did go from Relator's office to the secretary. And I would posit that if Relator believed that the secretary would not corroborate that testimony of Mr. Karras or of Mr. Fortunas, Relator could also have subpoenaed her to come in and testify.
That's not in the record anyway, right? Or what she would have done isn't in the record.
That's correct, but I was attempting to ask to answer Chief Justice's
question. In the Patchkey case, this court issued an admonishment that lawyers shouldn't be casual with respect to the duties they have as notaries. How does that case impact this?
And Cleary is what you said, Your Honor?
Papke.
Papke, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I would distinguish Papke, Feuerbach, and Schaefer. Those are the three cases where this court gave actual time out. And here's the distinctions that I would draw. In Papke, in addition to the notary, she also affirmatively misrepresented to her client that she had filed something when she had not filed it. And then 2 months later filed it and used the affidavit that her secretary signed purportedly with oral permission of the client and notarized that and put that as part of what she filed in the paternity case. In the Feuerbach case, in addition to the notary matters, he also affirmatively misrepresented to his client that he had filed things, and he took things one step further in that he took a timestamp from another case and superimposed
right.
it, and he did more.
Documents.
Schaefer, the attorney in Schaefer, actually masterminded the forgeries, if you will. He told his client, go ahead and sign your grandmother's name on this. Let's backdate all these documents. I'll go ahead and notarize it so it looks like she gave you all of this authority when she was still competent to give you the authority. So he masterminded. I would say that those three cases, that's the distinction between the current case, excuse me, and those three cases.
How can we get the attention of the bar to pay attention to their duties as notaries and not casually sign documents when individuals that they don't know to be the signatories aren't there?
Well, I think that there's a long line of cases where the court has instructed the bar that is the case and that is what should be done. And in that long line of cases, you know, the cases that were later cited, Friedman, Hefter, Kenny, Millick, Roberts, Thomas, this court all gave public reprimands. So in the past, this court has determined that it is sufficient to give a public reprimand and still send the message.
In those other cases, were they all isolated instances, or were there more than one, as in this case? Because the pattern is what is concerning me, the pattern of notarizing in this fashion or not notarizing in this fashion.
Okay. Well, I would point out on page 6 of the board's findings that they say, based upon the forensic evidence presented, there was a pattern of misconduct. So the panel weighted the forensic evidence and said, based upon this evidence, we find that she did not sign. Mm-hmm. What they didn't say was that she was never in his office, that the documents were never presented while she was in his office. What they said was she never signed them.
You talk about I keep thinking there's three counts of him signing or three claims he witnessed a forged signature.
There were three different dates involved.
But you only talk about him recalling her being in the office twice. What's his excuse or explanation of the third one?
Well, the first time documents were signed, it was supposed to be in Mr. Karras's office. Mr. Karras and Mr. Fortunas both testified that they went to the Root Road catering business, met David Pitcock and Patricia Pitcock there, and that first document was signed at the Root Road property.
So he's saying she was present at all three.
That's correct.
So your position is that she was there and she signed it, okay? But you're saying, but if you don't believe that, even if he did something wrong, he doesn't deserve to be actually suspended.
No,
is that right?
No. What he's saying is, based upon the conflicting testimony up to the point of the hearing, there was a real question as to whether or not Patricia Pitcock was there and signed it. Because in 2005, David signs an affidavit, which he files as part of a civil lawsuit, and says she was there and she signed it. She's deposed as part of the second lawsuit and says, I was there twice, but I didn't sign. David says, well, I'm not even sure if she was there. Maybe she was there once. So you have all this conflicting testimony.
But you don't have conflicting testimony that he signed the three documents. He said that in this case, that he signed the three documents.
That's David Pitcock's current testimony.
And his wife did not. And you've got a forensic expert that says this is David Pitcock's signature.
Right. Mr. Karras's position at this point is the panel found the forensic evidence to be credible, and based upon the forensic evidence, determined that Patricia did not sign it, and made that finding then of a pattern because of the forensic evidence. And what Mr. Karras is saying is, okay, the panel has made the credibility determinations. They've made the recommendation. The board has accepted that. I will accept that. Please give me what the board has recommended to you.
Okay, but one of the things that I'm a little troubled by is that Mr. Pitcock was not Mr. Karras' client.
That's correct.
But if we find what the board has come to the conclusion of, that he, in fact, orchestrated a fraud, maybe that's a little strong. Maybe they didn't quite find that. But he didn't notarize a woman's signature here. Is that serving his client's needs? I mean, one of those distinctions you made from your previous cases that you mentioned that why this is different, one of them was that the attorney actually orchestrated the false notarization and harmed his client as a result of it. Well, here there's an orchestration of false notarization, and does it benefit his client, or did he actually harm his client by orchestrating these false notarizations?
My understanding of the two lawsuits arising out of this, the first civil case was Mr. Pitcock suing Mr. Cafanteras because Mr. Pitcock believed that Mr. Cafanteras did not have exclusive title to the property, and therefore the sale, some of the monies from the sale of the property should have gone to Mr. Pitcock. The second lawsuit was the new purchaser of the property who sued Mr. Pitcock, and then Mr. Pitcock interpled Mr. Cafanteras and Mr. Karras into that civil lawsuit. That's the second lawsuit is where Mr. Karras, and I believe his testimony in the record was that after he was $26,000 or $27,000 into his defense costs, he had made an offer early on to sell her for $5,000. It wasn't accepted, and then closer to the trial date, the $5,000 settlement was accepted, and they settled it.
But
so it was a settlement of a lawsuit. It wasn't.
The validity of the documents.
I'm concerned with the use of the word restitution because I'm not sure that that's an accurate.
All right. The validity of the documents was in question.
My understanding of the issue in the first lawsuit, the 03 lawsuit, was that Mr. Pitcock says that he did not he believed that the quitclaim deed that he signed was only to be used as a guarantee for the repayment of the money, as it wasn't actually to transfer the property. Mr. Cafanteras' position was, I was willing to hold that in abeyance provided you made the payments. You never paid me back, so that sprung the transfer of the title.
As evidenced by a document that was not legally correct by virtue of the false notification.
Yes, based upon the forensic evidence, yes. And again, I guess I would reiterate that there have been a number of cases where this court has deferred to the credibility testimony of the witnesses, and I would posit that a review of the transcript shows that the witness testimony is in conflict, and that is specifically noted in the panel's report. And they determined I think that they made, or the bulk of their determination was based upon the forensic evidence. Mr. Karras accepts that forensic evidence, accepts what the board has found, and requests that he be given what the board has recommended to this court, which is a public reprimand.
Counsel, what is your understanding of what the panel found related to count one, which is violation of the rule prohibiting and revolving conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation, and conduct adversely reflecting on the lawyer's fitness to practice, which follows a conclusion that the testimony was in conflict. I guess I'm not quite clear what they found, and so what is your understanding of what they found?
My understanding of the hearing panel's recommendations and then the recommendations that the board accepted was that the forensic evidence the hearing panel found to be credible. Based upon the forensic evidence, the signature of P. Pidcock was not written by Patricia Pidcock. Therefore, if that signature was not written by Patricia Pidcock, when Mr. Karras notarized saying that she appeared and she signed, that was false, dishonest, fraud, misrepresentation, or some combination thereof. Okay. And that the second, the 102A6 is, at least if you look at all the cases, 1102A4 and 1102A6, whenever there's a notary issue, we're always coupled together. So if you find the first one, I think you get to the second one by virtue of having found the first one.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Caliguri, you have 43 seconds.
Counsel, what is your understanding of what the panel found there and under the first paragraph, under conclusions of law?
Well, my understanding is that the panel actually did find the testimony of David Pidcock and Patricia Pidcock to be credible, and I think it was corroborated by the forensic evidence. So I think that they were finding that they were truthful. What I think they were saying, and I wanted to bring this up because before when you asked me if there was any corroboration for the respondent's story, I said absolutely not. There was one witness, Mark Fortunas, who was a friend of his, that testified that he was present when all those documents were signed by Patricia Pidcock. But at the end of the day, I think they're saying that we have a respondent who's testifying before the panel and saying that this woman signed these documents, but they gave weight to the testimony not only of David and Patricia Pidcock, but also to the forensic scientist.
So we have at the hearing testimony from the friend of the respondent.
Correct.
Which you regard as not reliable. And we have testimony of an admitted forger who wants money for his forgery.
Well, that's... Right?
So he's reliable, but the friend's not.
Well, I would respectfully disagree with that. First of all, David Pidcock...
Well, he's not a forger?
No, but David Pidcock, he admitted that he forged.
He doesn't want money?
Well, David Pidcock was subpoenaed in. He had nothing to do with this case before we came to see him. That's in the record. That $5,000 settlement has not been paid. He wasn't seeking to get paid. He was dragged into this proceeding, and the difference between him and the respondent is that he admitted that he forged his wife's name, whereas the respondent continues to deny, despite the fact that he's a lawyer and the forensic evidence, that this woman did not sign these documents. So, I mean, if you're going to make a credibility determination, David Pidcock was much more credible.
Well, he doesn't admit that she didn't sign them. He doesn't know who signs them, right?
David Pidcock?
No, the respondent.
Well, we think he knows exactly who signed them, but his testimony is she signed them. That's what he's saying, and that's the dishonest conduct. That's the aggravating factor that requires the actual suspension.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Marshall, will you adjourn court, please?